Hallo und herzlich willkommen beim Female Peace Palace Podcast. Mein Name ist Fabienne Immlinger und heute gibt's eine Folge auf Englisch. Mit meinen Gesprächspartnerinnen Manuela Igera und Michaela Melian haben wir uns im Vorfeld darauf verständigt, das Gespräch auf Englisch zu führen. Das ist zwar von keiner von uns dreien die Muttersprache, aber die Sprache, in der wir uns am besten treffen konnten. Ich wünsche euch viel Spaß bei der Folge und jetzt geht's los. Welcome to the podcast Female Peace Palace. My name is Fabienne Immlinger and I am joined today by two interdisciplinary artists based in Munich. And I warmly welcome Michaela Melian and Manuela Igera. Thank you for both agreeing to having this conversation with me. And I invited Michaela and Manuela to the podcast because both of them created memorials or counter monuments here in Munich, and their respective works situate themselves in an ongoing conversation and one could also say confrontation about memory culture and monuments. And this conversation or confrontation has gained a lot of impetus in the United States and in Europe since the Black Lives Matter protest in 2020. And I'm sure we will come back to that point in our conversation. But the search for new forms of representation and remembrance, and the particular questions of how to bring marginalized, repressed, forgotten, unheard, or invisible voices to the fore is present in both your works. And that's why I invited you here, of course. And it is so, moreover, because both of your works engage with a history of violence, namely colonial history and the history of the NS regime. And I won't say too much in the beginning, but I want to jump right into the conversation by asking you, Manuela, about your sound and augmented reality monument, Cumbia del Colón Irritable, which is situated. And we can discuss about, you know, situated or associated with the Columbusplatz in Munich, and which you created with the digital artist Merlin Stadler. And I just want to say something briefly about the context, because the monument originated in the context of merging two larger projects, if I understood it right, namely past statements by the city of Munich and the cooperation between the Munich-based initiative Denk Female and the New York-based initiative Make Us Visible. And this latter cooperation between Make Us Visible and Denk Female tries to make, and this is a quote, to make gender equity monuments visible in the streets of New York for Make Us Visible, which originated in New York, and then was followed in Munich in autumn 22 by a similar project exhibition. And this was the cooperation between Denk Female and Make Us Visible. And I think this initiative was then integrated into the past statements project by the city of Munich, where various artists, among them also you, Michaela, were asked to engage with, and I quote again, monuments that have become questionable because of their sometimes violence, glorifying and excluding visual language. And the reason why I am mentioning it, particularly the Make Us Visible, Denk Female initiative, is because it seems very interesting to me, Manuela, that you did precisely not create a statue commemorating or introducing a female or non-binary figure on the visual level, as many other artists did that created monuments in the context of that initiative. But what we see in Cumbia del Colón Irritable is a seated figure of Columbus sprayed with red paint. And I am assuming, please correct me. I am assuming it is the statue found in Belgravia Square in London that was sprayed in October 2021. So we see this Columbus statue and sitting in front of a pico, a sound system particular to the Caribbean coastal region of Colombia. So this is what we see. And then there is a sound added or music added, which I assume is the cumbia, and various female voices that are introduced in the course of the song. And on the visual level, the statue explodes during the going on of the song, suggesting, I think, correct me again if you intended something else, suggesting, you know, that the music kind of is exploding or the voices are exploding the statue. So my question to you would be, you know, why did you choose this approach? And what was your artistic process behind developing this particular kind of monument?
Yeah, so this work in particularly has several layers of content or symbolism. So the first one is like the fact that the monument is exploding and it's toppling in a way, well, clearly exploding. And it's inspired by the topplings that the Misak community in Colombia made at the end of 2020 and beginning 2021. The Misak community from the Cauca region, they are a highly organized indigenous community. And they have a very clear political actions. They are super organized politically and culturally as well. And they decided to start a series of actions, which I call like the decolonial actions, in which they will topple monuments from Spanish colonizers. They did three, the most important. I mean, the first one started in September 2020, which was the toppling of Sebastián de Belalcázar, which is a famous Spanish colonizer. And then after that, in April 21, they topple Gonzalo Jiménez de Quesada, another one. There are like different founders, the founder of Cali, the founder of Popayán, several, let's say, main cities in Colombia. And Gonzalo Jiménez de Quesada, also founder of Bogotá. And they created these organized toppling actions as the result of a symbolic trial. So what they did is like they made a trial to these colonizers and they found them guilty. Guilty of genocide, guilty of stealing land, guilty of abuse, slavery, all that stuff. And what they do is like symbolically, they would bring down the monument to make justice. And one of the most interesting things that I find about these actions is the use of music. So the first thing that happened after the monument is torn down is they start playing music. They have their instruments, they have their drums, they have the flutes, and starts, let's say, like a party and a celebration of justice, of this trial in which they find guilty these figures. I mean, it's very delicate because these many of these monuments sometimes have been set in what used to be sacred places from these communities. So let's say the Morro del Tulcán is a very sacred summit for this community. And in that particular place, they place these colonizers. And well, that happens as well a lot in Latin America with churches. You know, they bring these Catholic churches and they put them exactly on the sacred places that used to be the spiritual place for these communities, which is like a very violent way, no, of imposing new beliefs or whatever. So this is like the first thing which is inspired on that is like using music to also engage the body to relate with this injustice or with this just way of trying to make a call to such problematics. And yeah, it was also on the frame of this very, I call it iconoclast movement that happened all over the world during that time. Also in Colombia, there was like a very intense period of time of protest and manifestation. It was very violent. There was a lot of police violence. They don't only, the indigenous topple down these monuments, but the general public and the civilians also topple many other in Colombia at that time. And they used to use, of course, red paint and many other types of paints and so on. And all of these things were also replicated in Europe when they brought down also Leopold and all those kings and all that stuff. So it was like really, let's say, like it was like boiling type of energy happening around those monuments. That's one of the layers. And the song is a cumbia song, which is also a traditional rhythm in Colombia. And the other layer, it's like the lyrics, which is Pauline Fussmann. You also know her. She did the voiceover, and we talk about the symptoms and treatments for the colon irritable. The colon irritable is really funny because there are many memes in Colombia about that. Colon and colon are almost the same word, except for a very small accent. And colon is colon irritable. This illness, I think in German, is Reisdarm or a Reizkolon. They always make memes about the colon irritable with colon. And Pauline is talking about the symptoms of this illness and the possible treatments in a very German way. It's all the German text on top of the song. And this is like the part in which I think this is like our the colonial indigestion. And maybe sometimes we can find some cures, or maybe we will suffer from it from the entire life. And that's basically the, let's say, the layers and the inspirations for this contra monument that is unapologetic on the message of destroying the monument mm-hmm. without any remorse.
Mm-hmm. And I have two questions. The first, there is in the voices, one hears also a kind of, I think, speech or original material. Can you maybe also say who that is?
Yeah, there is a collage of several fan footage, or how you call it, of several historical or documents. In particular, there is one that is from Francia Márquez. Francia Márquez is the first Black female vice president of Colombia. She was elected literally last year with Gustavo Petro, which is now the one of the first leftist presidents in Colombia in a super long 200 years of right conservative governments and regimes. And let's say like this government happening right now is one of the most progressive. And, you know, it's a little bit this chain of events happening also in Latin America, you know, in which some things shift a little bit to the left in Chile with Boric, in Lula, with Lula in Brazil, AMLO in Mexico, and Petro in Colombia, let's say, also makes part of this kind of approach. And he is very progressive. And then Francia Márquez was competing against him in the first primary elections in which you choose the candidate that goes. And then Petro decided to take Francia Márquez as vice president. It's an historical event for Colombia to have a Black female. She is an activist. She got like a very important prize of environmentalism and stuff like that. I mean, she's an incredible woman, and I admire her very much. And she's constantly was the first politicians that brought to the front the decolonial and colonial and anti-racist discourse to the general public, like in the face. She's talking about that. She's talking about patriarchy. She's talking about colonialism. She's talking about racism and how to tackle in a political way and in a social way. So I'm a big fan. I'm a huge admirer of this of this woman. And every time I can, I use samples of her voice and her historic and her political discourse. And then I use her voice to always be present in many of my works as well. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And last question, I was wondering about the Columbusplatz. I mean, first of all, was it a set place? Were you offered to do something at Columbusplatz? And how was it for you also with, you know, there is a history also of contestation of Columbusplatz in Munich. And also what I found very interesting is that, you know, Columbusplatz, it is a kind of non-place and it does precisely not have a statue of Columbus. So can you say a bit more about the actual place, Columbusplatz?
Yeah, so in principle, everyone could choose to make a contra monument anywhere, but the first place that I thought was Columbusplatz. So I actually asked for this place in particular to create this contra monument, basically because it's part of my work and my approach to decolonialism and decolonial feminism, which is like kind of the current that inspires or from where I drink to create my own work. So yeah, the Columbusplatz also, that was happening in October, close to October, September. And then the 12th of October, it's what they call in Spain, El Día del Idioma, so the day of language, and it's the day that Columbus arrived. And that discourse has been radically shifting in the last years, in which they say, no, there's nothing to celebrate. We're not going to celebrate the Día del Idioma. This is the day in which the genocide started. So part of my idea was like to release La Cumbia del Colon Irritable the 12th of October as a response to this particular commemoration, which is a racist and genocide commemoration in Spain and obviously in Latin America as well. But it's been trying to change to El Día de los Pueblos, which is the day of the people or the peoples in general. And let's say that that was my approach to the Columbus Monument, which was the one that would relate better to what I do or to what I want to say or to what I know how to say. So that's why it was specifically Columbus, kind of a replicating the dynamics of the Misak, but in the place where I live.
Mm-hmm. And it's also interesting, last remark, because I don't know if it is the Belgravia statue of Columbus that you are referring to on the visual level, but interestingly enough, that statue was put up in 1992. So relatively late. And the Columbus Platz is also relatively late, in 1903 only. So it is the Columbus Platz in Munich is part of, you know, the whole colonial enterprise at the end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century. But it's a renewed inscription of colonial history into the public realm. But I want to now ask you, Michaela, because you also made a monument or a counter monument for the Past Statements Initiative, which I found very interesting. In this piece of work, you cover the Neptune Fountain in the old botanical garden in Munich that was built during the Nazi era. And you cover this with mesh tarpaulin, so this kind of material also used for construction work. And the foil is printed with an image of a work by the Jewish artist Maria Luiko from 1938, entitled Mourning. And Maria Luiko was deported and killed by the Nazis. But you also, from 2008 to 2010, created the virtual monument Memory Loops, which is a virtual memorial for the victims of National Socialism. And in this piece, you created collages of voices and music thematically linked to the topography of National Socialism in Munich. And it comprises 300 German and 175 English audio tracks based on transcriptions of historical and recent material from victims of National Socialism. So these are two very different memorial works. And I would like to invite you to reflect on the different ways in which you approach these works, also, of course, with the time difference. And particularly, I would like to tell us something about your dealing with or use of space and the choice of the different visual and or audio approaches you used.
Okay. I think it would have been better two questions, but let's start with Memory Loops, because it's already, I started it in 2008, that is more than 14 years ago. And you didn't mention that this thing was a commissioned work. So it was a commission. 20 artists internationally were invited to make the city of Munich a proposal for a memorial for the victims of National Socialism. This process of the city of Munich took many, many years to decide that they need something like that. And at the end, when they invited to this competition, they didn't offer a place for this monument. They wanted to have a monument, but they didn't offer a place. So it was inscripted in the papers that we should define our own place. And since, as an artist, you know, if there is no place for something to realize, there will not be place, because it's a long political process, even in the very dense areas in inner cities where this history has to be located. So I decided by then, that was in 2008, to hand in an idea of a memorial who doesn't have a physical place. It should be located in the internet and should be consisting only from audio tracks. And if you translate the word audio track into German, it says Tonspuren. And the word Spur also means trace, like traces. My aim is always to bring a history or content into the art piece who is kind of left out by art politics, by politics, whatever, social development. For example, when I started with my art studies, there were no any art teacher, female art teacher at Munich Art School, only females in the workshop. So like for weaving or pottery. So there was not a single female famous artist in the art education. And these topics really made me think political. Who is kind of deciding what will be read about our life and our work? And so I decided to dig deeper. And coming back to Memory Loops, the decision to do this audio piece was just that there was no place for the monument. And as far as I see it, it was the first memorial who was built internationally just as a not visible piece based in the internet on audio. When this was decided by the art commission or art jury who decided on the proposals, it happened by then in 2008, a huge kind of shitstorm in the city. Historians and politicians were totally against it, that I should do something like that. Because today you forget always that that was the beginning of complex internet, and there was not a mobile technology where you can go, could go to the internet. So it was just like a conversation or communication tool, but not as meant as an art tool or a tool who could work with content. So this was the problem I had to deal with. But then the city decided I should do it. And afterwards, it was very well respected internationally. I am not sure if I should now go over the past statements, because I could talk for hours about Memory Loops, because it's so complex. It's 24 hours audio work produced, and it's not like with Manuela's piece. It's not a single original voice. It's all done by actors and children. Because the problem was that all the witnesses I could talk to were very, very old. And I wanted to have young voices to make the whole topic actual, because all these topics like experience of racism, experience of like injustice and so on are kind of the same thing today. So it's an ongoing story. So I wanted to have it like actual. So it took me at the end 2 years. In these 2 years, I didn't do any other project, and it was totally exhausting. And at the end, there were like 110 people working with me. I hope that they are still content about this experience, because I tried to spread the whole budget under these people who helped me. So if we do the step now to the actual work, past statement, for the past statement, it was also like publicly initiated, but it was a public call, a different thing. So I wasn't invited. I handed in this proposal for this Botanische Garten. This was, for me, it was important because it comes from the same origin from my thoughts, like with Memory Loops, that this garden has so many layers of history that it doesn't start with the National Socialism. It starts long before, because this garden was a public place where people hang out, and it was kind of a Bürgergarten. And then in National Socialism, it was took over and totally converted. And today, again, it's a Bürgergarten, and it's for very special people who are kind of homeless. They are illegals in Munich. They all hang out there, and it's in the totally town center. And it's, I think it's the greenest part in the town center. And in the middle, you have this fountain by this very famous sculptor who was teaching at Munich Academy. And at the same time, when he was teaching, this young artist, who wasn't only Jewish, she was an artist, a female artist, very successful. And she was in the committee of the contemporary art scene in Munich, who was deciding on exhibitions, because there where the fountain is now was before the Munich Glass Palace. And that was the Museum for Contemporary Art. And she was in the committee there and decided who could show there. And she was at the same time working in town, was included of every publicity after the National Socialists came to power and had to live under very poor circumstances, forbidden to work. Her sister was one of the first female lawyers in Bavaria, and both of them were kind of thrown out of their professions and were deported in 1939 to Kaunas in Lithuania, and they're killed by the National Socialists immediately after the train with 1,000 Munich inhabitants, Jewish inhabitants, arrived. And so for sure she had this kind of history because she was declared as a Jewish artist. But she was also an artist. So I think it's always so problematic that you add this so much to the biography, because she was made to a Jew through National Socialists. So I would really oppose against it that it's just a Jewish artist. She's a very important female artist for Munich art history. And because of being declared as only Jewish, her work is totally destroyed. And so in Munich, there's not a single work of her paintings. Anything is here, only some proof prints she did, and she gave to other artists, non-Jewish artists. She gave them as a gift for birthday or so on. These things are now in the collection of the city. And since this woman is not at all visible, only in this kind of nationalist history, not in art history, I thought I wanted to tell these both stories in the same time. So you have the fountain of this Gottbegnadete artist. So these 300 artists declared by Adolf Hitler as God-given genius who didn't have to go to war, and they are allowed till 45 to build art. They should build the new National Socialist Society, and he was one of them. So he could build this fountain there at the same place where the place was before for upcoming international dealing young artists with other ideas, what could be the aim, were kind of destroyed. So if I cover this Neptune, this kind of, he stands for like Columbus, like an authoritarian figure who rules the world in a way, cover it with this material who is on the one hand cheap, but on the other hand, it's a material you can look through and you see the statue behind it. And still you have the print of this face who is not really be clear if it's a woman or a man. It's in Germany, it's Trauernde. So it doesn't say so much about the gender. You could also see it as someone who is hiding the face between the hands. It just wants to point out that there is a sculpture in the middle of the city. And it's kind of on, if you go on in the internet, it's one of the marked places where you go and take a selfie if you have been to Munich. So it's internationally, you have this fountain in the background. And so it's for the time of past statements, this kind of image for travelers is kind of hidden. And she comes on top of it. And afterwards, it will be the same again, but maybe some people have then a knowledge about the place.
What seems so interesting to me already in your responses, in both of your responses, what you told us now is so complex and layered history with so many, aspects and historical layers underneath it. And I think if I understood it right, one concern of current debates or also the renewal of memorials and memory culture is precisely also the question of how to not only depict lost or marginalized or killed or repressed narratives, but also precisely how to give back the complexity of a monument or a historical place of figures. And I was wondering, how do you approach this complexity? Because it's very central to both your work. How do you translate that into this artistic process? And related to that, how do you conceive of, the people on the receiving end? How much information or how much context do you give them, or how little, And particularly, you know, with respect to the fact that part of your work, I mean, the memory loops and also your work, Manuela, can be seen. You don't have to physically be in Munich. You can just go on the internet and look it up. So I was wondering if you could say a bit more about that.
I think the last point you made is very important. So when I decided on by memory loops that I will use the internet, like with this very kind of low access internationally to this story, because I'm pretty critical about monuments at all. If you walk by every day by some things, you know why it's built up, but at the end you don't care. And so I think anyway, memory has to do, if you want to remember things, if you want to be aware of things, and also it's sometimes helpful to forget things and to rethink them. And so I decided to make it like as open as possible and as easy accessible as possible. And I liked very much the idea that people from all over the world can have an approach to the special Munich history. I was, because of that project, I was told that it was the first complex art piece in that way in the internet. I was invited quite internationally to many forums like memory places or symposiums or universities or art institutions. And I thought it was very interesting that there are all over the world, you find people who had to leave Europe, you had to leave Germany because of this experience in that time. The stories are pretty similar. And even if you compare it to other kind of horrible stories who happened like in South America or in Asia, if people had to leave countries, if they got kind of racial experience, they could find themselves in this story. So I thought it was really interesting to find out that people even, I don't know, in Taiwan, their university was interested in the piece. And I like that very much because that makes it the awareness of, you should really think about it, what it means to experience these things. And just to add what I said before, this project doesn't cover only the years between 1933 and 45, as I think this started much before. So it started in the early 20th century, at least at the beginning of the 19th century, where you had already some anti-Jewish or or racist laws here in Munich. For example, the Munich police, they first started to have this register on like homosexual people, like people who are not having a fixed place where they live, or on Jewish businesses. They had this kind of register. So in 33, as soon as the Nazis had the power, they had just go there and had the register whom they could take to Dachau. So all these things I wanted to tell, that it's not from one day to the other. There's a long history how people are treated in the city, not only in the city, in the whole country.
Manuela, I would like also to hear about your approach towards, you know, making complex historical experiences, marginalized voices present, and also about this aspect of, you know, the virtual space.
Yeah, well, before that, first of all, I wanted to extend my admiration to Michaela and her work, because I think it's very intense. The little exploration I made on it, it really appeals to an emotional encounter with those things, even though I'm not really linked to that history, because it's not my time, it's not my country, it's nothing, you know, it's like, but still, this interesting aspect, this substance that can also be related to me is what I found the most interesting of the work. Yeah, my approach to this is to question and friction who tells history, no? Why is objective to say that history is like that and that historical figures deserve these places? And that has to do with something that I have researched before that is called the coloniality of knowledge. So colonialism and the coloniality in general is not only that event happening 500 years ago. It's the extension of those colonial practices until today. So basically colonialism, modernity and capitalism are the same entity that fed itself from those beginnings. And then for me, it's really, really important because that dynamics extended to the culture cultural aspect and to the knowledge aspect. It's like in some point also what became the valid history and the history that is the history, no? And then for me, it's really, really important to point out that there are many ways to tell history and to create memory. And we live in this coloniality of power in which there is one installed system, which is like, in a way, the scientific system, which is like kind of a this peer-reviewed knowledge that is the one that becomes valid. I am a totally fact science person in many ways, but when the science system came to the pyramid, the other ways of producing knowledge, which has nothing to do with creating papers peer-reviewed, but with creating experiences, with creating oral transmissions, oral knowledge, the ways you can live, the ways in which you relate with the territory is knowledge. And this knowledge is not in a paper or peer-reviewed, and that makes it not valid to the eyes of the European Western system. And that, for me, created like this huge division on the side what is valid and what is not, and how these hierarchies on who is more important started to dominate the narrative of knowledge. So for me, it's very important to create this epistemic friction in between saying, yeah, this is a way of knowledge, but we also, or some other cultures, can create different ways of knowledge that are not based on the hegemonic scientific system or the historical way of maintaining memory and all that stuff, no? So for me, it was, in a way, using these Columbus statues also has to do with the internet. I mean, with the memes, with how information spreads. It was not necessarily for a specific purpose or reason. No, it's because that image became very famous. And that image, everyone knows, is Columbus, Columbus vandalized. So yeah, that is like my approach to this, is creating friction with the use of cultural elements that differ from these white Western aesthetics. No, I think there is also a coloniality of aesthetics in a way. No, what is the beauty canon? So how things should look like. And for me, it's very important to bring up these other aesthetics with my Pico, and for example, this color sound device, which has a very colorful aesthetics, no? That brings and try to break literally Columbus, or at least create some friction, no? Create this question, like, this also exists, and it shouldn't be less than that. It should be more than that. It's just is there and should be able to accompany the ways in we make history or the ways that we create memory, because in that sense, we could have like broader process and more inclusive process of creating memory, taking care of history, and also acknowledge different points of view.
I think this very much relates to what you said before, Michaela, about, you know, this kind of relation to memory or memory culture, where it's also sometimes, I'm paraphrasing you wrongly, but good to forget things, to kind of rethink. Because this is, I think, one of the problems. Not only you pass by these monuments that already exist, but it's just places where politicians come and commemorate, but it's getting this kind of empty or deferred ritual of memory, which has maybe a tendency not to produce an active and also an engaged encounter of individuals with this specific memory. And what seemed interesting also to me, and this is coming back to what you said, Manuela, about creating epistemic friction. Because I think, Michaela, what you said before about, you know, memory loops, kind of, there was a shitstorm, like, how could you do this in this way? And I also read in newspaper articles, one of the things that was criticized was that you could, you know, the way it works, you can walk through the city and there is a 0800 number, which you can call from your cell phone, and then you will hear the memory loop. So one of the headlines was, you know, Gedenken auf Anruf. So, you know, memory upon calling. So I'm going to introduce a word, and maybe it's not the right word, but what was interesting to me was that immediately in this moment where you disrupt this, one of the moments, or one of the judgments, it seems to me, that happens for invalidation is the question of appropriateness, which is, of course, a very, very difficult and also ethical question with the representation of a history of violence and also the kind of How can you represent victims or a narrative of victims? In some ways, it seems to me that with both your works, this kind of question of, is this appropriate? For example, Michaela, I mean, apart from the fact that, you know, this kind of virtual aspect was criticized, what was also criticized was that children read out Nazi documents, and that was kind of considered inappropriate. And with your work, Manuela, I'm, you know, projecting things, but in a European context, I could imagine this kind of profanization, the colonia irritable, and also the kind of aspect of dancing, like those are not proper ways to commemorate or to, you know, deal with memory and the history of violence. So I was wondering if you could, you know, say a bit more about that, this question of appropriateness.
Yeah, I mean, I really like this moment of a book from Frantz Fanon, this Martinican black scholar who developed super interesting theories and stuff about racism and colonized beings and stuff like that. And he said, like, okay, so imagine the black person with the foot of the white on the face doing like, you know, and then say, oh, maybe this is a bit wrong. I'm sorry. Are you expecting that the black person is going to get up and give you a hug? Well, no. You know, this friction is necessary because what happened was extremely violent. And I'm saying that necessarily we have to react with violence, but yes, with friction. Because sometimes I think that Europeans are always wanting to make consents. And that is possible in homogenic societies when everyone is a little bit alike. But when you have like, very unequal societies in general, consensus is very different. And sometimes what it's more necessary is having conscious friction. I think that it's more inclusive in many ways to develop politics, to develop everything, I think. So for me, it's very necessary to sometimes not be very appropriate, to actually go against what is established and creating those frictions unapologetically, destroying the monuments, bringing them down, painting them, using counter-narratives like, for example, what Michaela did in the work, using the voice of children to do that. That is very pointy, and that is something that, of course, is going to get into the hearts or to the, how you say, to the constructions of some people. But I think those things are necessary because the acts made have consequences, and these consequences shouldn't be ignored or minimize for the sake of keeping things calm. It's my personal opinion. I don't necessarily think this is an objective way of treat conflict. It's the way I consider or makes the most friction, more questions that can help to construct better ways to build narratives of historical narratives or memory narratives.
Thank you, Michaela.
I also would say the word friction is the best way to address the whole thing, because I have the opinion there's not a single experience you have who's kind of 100% this way or that way. There exists in anything, any topic, you have not at all two sides, you have like many sides and many layers. And I think that's kind of the power of art, that you can make this kind of experimental for the people, that they can experience. It's not helpful to take one perspective like you have it in an historic panorama where a certain visitor is meant to take this position. So I think it should be, everything should be on the table and many perspectives. And then you have this violence more as an experience for everyone. Then for sure the problem we as artists have, is this appropriate? Can we do that? These two cases, like memory loops and past statements, there are initiatives by politicians to have a good aim for that. And still it's a commissioned work. So I'm still doing it different if it would just my own work. But on the other hand, in the public space, it's so complicated to do these interventions that it's very helpful that the city is supporting you with that. Otherwise, you couldn't do that with all the permissions and things you have to clear to do this. So I think in this context, I'm very happy to do these things. For example, the past statements thing was meant as a, just like a intervention for a certain month. But now the city thought that we should keep it for a while to make an idea of how can we deal with this place who only tells one story, but not the other story. I think that's nice that art can help with that. And in this sense, I also am quite content because the old botanical garden was already on my watch map when I was an art student at the Munich Academy, because we had this research group of like six students by our own on the history of the art school, because there was not a single publication on the professors what they did in the Third Reich, and not on pupils who had to leave the school, because before 100 years ago, the Munich Art School was very, very international. So from all over the planet, people came here to learn painting because they had this historical painting school. And this is kind of very interesting that many people like from the Americanas came here to study painting and brought it back in their home countries. And this was over then. And I did in that time, that was really in the 80s, I did the research on this fountain. And then the past statements in call was the right moment to bring this knowledge in what I had like collected so many
it's
years ago.
It's also kind of a loop.
Yeah. It's all, yeah, history is somehow looping. And we try to a little bit more of these loops as far as we can do that. But I think it, as I could see it, it's really nice that we talk here about that. And I'm so glad that in these years I do that now, it changed so much. And this is now such an important topic in the center of society. And that makes me really glad, because when I did these things like 15 years ago, or even when I started Memory Loops, it was always, oh, this is kind of political art. How annoying is that? So I think any art is political. It has a role in, like you said before, in capitalism, and it has a role in the social discourse, and it represents the society, what is possible in art. So it should be also reflected in the work of art in that way.
Das war das wunderbare Schlusswort von Michaela Melian. Danke an die beiden nochmal für ihre Perspektiven und ihren Input. Wenn ihr mehr über Female Peace Palace erfahren wollt, dann geht auf die Seite der Kammerspiele oder der Monazensia, abonniert unseren Podcast, tretet mit uns in Kontakt. Wir freuen uns über Rückmeldungen und Anregungen. Und jetzt sage ich bis zum nächsten Mal.